Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what is the role of class in American politics and how does that shape the election? And first, how has Donald Trump reshaped the federal judiciary and the Supreme Court, and what does it mean for democracy?
And I'm joined by three experts in American history, politics, and law. To my right is University of Auckland Associate Professor of American History and author of Let Us Vote, Jennifer Frost. To my left is politics and policy lecturer and author of Mental Health Policy in Global Context, Tim Fadjin. And on Zoom, we have University of California, Irvine, Chancellor's Professor of Law, Michelle Bratcher-Goodwin. Michelle Bratcher-Goodwin is author of six books, including her latest, Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Welcome to the Americans, all three of you. It's so great to be back in the studio and talking about these really important issues. Michelle Goodwin, we must bring you in to talk to us about what this nomination and moving forward of the new Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett means in terms of democracy. There's a lot of concern being articulated among Democrats that the Republicans are, in fact, trying to rush it forward just in case they need to repeat a sort of Bush versus Gore in the year 2000, in which they stopped counting the votes and the presidency went to George Bush before they concluded. Perhaps we should back up to what happened then, what that decision meant politically and legally, and if these are just fears or if there's any legitimate concern to be had.
Well, these are legitimate concerns to be had, and I would signal that by the very fact that within the United States Supreme Court, there has been controversy as to whether this is a Trump court. Some of those concerns have been raised by Justice Sotomayor, suggesting that the president has had a speed track to the Supreme Court, thereby not necessarily following all of the processes that would be expected by any other administration. And in fact, her concerns have been shared by many others, not just on the speed track front, but because of the kinds of criticisms that the president has made against federal judges at the district court level, appellate court level, and even at the Supreme Court, that's been so extreme that it's resulted in Chief Justice John Roberts issuing a statement saying there's no such thing as Trump judges, Obama judges, Clinton or Bush judges. But the reality of the sentiment and a kind of growing mistrust of the court seems to persist. And so now you've asked about this question with Judge Amy Coney Barrett, and this has been a bit of a inconsistent with what happened in the Obama administration with the nomination of Merrick Garland, and whether this looks like Bush v. Gore. Well, in Bush v. Gore, what was very interesting there is that there were still votes outstanding in Florida, and the election had been called by the Bush camp, and it was contested then by Al Gore. And the Supreme Court of the state of Florida had suggested a pathway forward of actually doing a recount so that it could be clear who actually had the votes. That was challenged by the Bush team, and it went right up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in a split decision, 5-4, the conservatives on the court basically stopped the count. They said that that this was the Supreme Court of Florida making law on its own, that what they were doing was arbitrary and capricious. The liberals on the court said that there was a way of fashioning this in a constitutional manner, and that it was actually important for the vote to take place because what's at stake was a fundamental constitutional right, that is the right to vote, the right for votes to be counted so that we could have a free and fair election. There are those that are saying by rushing Judge Amy Coney Barrett onto the Supreme Court, if there is a similar kind of challenge because we're still trying to tally the votes, especially during a period of COVID, that we could see a replay of that. The presumption there is that Judge Amy Coney Barrett would not rule independently on the facts, but in fact would basically be a pawn of the Trump administration. Now, I say that not believing that necessarily myself, but it is to say that's the argument that's being waged now.
So let me turn to Jennifer Frost, American historian, and put this into context in terms of history. What has the role been of the courts in terms of either protecting or diminishing democracy over the course of American history?
Yes. Well, I think my immediate response to that would be really thinking about the ways in which the Supreme Court has been crucial for expanding suffrage for American citizens. And if we look at the decisions, particularly of the 1960s, where definitely legislation passed by Congress that aimed to enfranchise African Americans, getting rid of literacy tests, getting rid of other sorts of discrimination was validated by the court. And even, principles like one person, one vote were validated by the court in the 1960s. And I guess my kind of take would be since then, really with the Rehnquist court, who was a Nixon appointee who was basically anti the civil rights movement and the Voting Rights Act, was to kind of counter and undermine that. So we have seen the court play a role in the expansion of democracy and access to the ballot, and I think since then, contraction.
So in our email exchange earlier, we talked about that you hadn't seen such a contraction really, except for when you go way back into like Dred Scott.
Yeah. Well, I think, it's really the question of democracy, right? So what do we mean by democracy? And one of the definitions is suffrage and participation in the political system. But the other definition of democracy is that the legislation that is passed by the democratic branch of government, i.e. Congress, should stand. And so we do see instances before the Civil War with the so-called Taney Court and the infamous, really worst decision ever, many people would say, the Dred Scott decision of 1857. And then also the New Deal Court in the 1930s that was pushing back against New Deal legislation, trying to regulate the economy. In both of those situations, we have highly partisan times. We have the court weighing in on political controversies with very narrow decisions or erroneous, wrong decisions in the Dred Scott case. And actually, in the sense, in both cases, it backfired. And so you had undemocratic decisions being made by the court where they were overturning legislation and passed by Congress. And it, in both cases, it backfired. So it'll be interesting to see, does that happen in 2021?
So in addition to that, I wonder, Michelle, if you have an idea of what's been happening up until now with these so-called shadow docket cases. What is that all about, and how does that figure into this?
Well, the challenge with the shadow docket case, and it builds off of this speed track into the Supreme Court, means that the Supreme Court can rule on an issue and not actually provide a majority opinion. So we saw that involving voting in Alabama, where the state of Alabama said, we don't want people to be able to drive up and drop off their ballots. And that was challenged all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court supported the state. This was a case that was brought by individuals with disabilities as well as civil rights groups saying we're in the middle of COVID in order to keep people safe. We know these lines are going to be long. There are polling locations that have been closed. Then let's make it easier for these individuals, including the elderly, by allowing them to drop off their ballots. Challenged up to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court upholds the decision that people shouldn't be allowed to do that. It is the liberals on the court who end up writing a dissent, Justice Sotomayor, joined by others on the court, but we have no idea why the majority came out in the way that they did. No written record whatsoever. And so that's what's considered this shadow doctrine, which is you don't know exactly what the doctrine actually is, how the Supreme Court is coming to the conclusions that it's making in those regards.
So there is real cause for concern about the democratic status of the United States of America right now.
Oh, absolutely. And let's be clear that this has been lingering, right? So we've already heard about Dred Scott. I mean, there's not been an end. What we saw in 1965, after very bloodied attempts by peaceful protesters to secure the right to vote, which had already been instantiated in the Constitution. And yet in the 1960s, Black people were still, being beaten up by police. hoses on them, dogs on them and whatnot, just to vote. In a state like Mississippi, Black people had to guess how many jelly beans in a jar, how many bubbles on a bar of soap, memorize the Constitution, repeat it backwards, all these kind of things that are clearly not keeping with a constitutional democracy. The 1965 Voting Rights Act changed all of that. But in a very recent case, while John Roberts has been the Chief Justice on the Supreme Court, a pivotal part of the Voting Rights Act, which was signed into law in 1965 by President Johnson, was struck down. What the majority of the court said, the conservatives on the court, was that, look, we're in a post-racial time. There's no need for the Department of Justice to do this kind of supervision when states want to change the voting regulations in a particular state. The presumption is that we're beyond the kind of specter of the kind of racism that we've seen consistently in American history. And that, of course, has turned out to not be the case. And there are myriad examples that could be listed out as to why we don't see that kind of equality that they presumed with regard to voting.
Tim Fadjin, you had some other areas of concern. What are your concerns?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I think your comment just now about this post-racial time, you wrote recently about your experiences in Minneapolis, and it's a place that I lived for 2 years as well. So some of those places you were describing in that piece sort of struck a chord with me. And I guess what I'm wondering is related to that, I suppose, is this notion, this theme that keeps coming up in our week-to-week meetings on this, which is probably something new to an audience here, but not so much in the United States, is this emphasis on courts. And even talking about shadow docket and the role of judges in the voting process is something that's just quite, would be head-scratching to many people that are probably listening at home. And I wonder, at the end of your piece, you close by appealing to the reader's sense of if they want a more just society, the first step is to ensure that voting rights are protected this year. And I'm wondering, how do you sort of square that, given what you're just describing about the role of courts in the electoral system in the United States?
Well, I think the two are not mutually exclusive. Right. So it is important yet that we protect the right to vote and that people are able to vote as safely as possible. Part of the democracy is also appealing to governors and legislatures at the state level and also at the federal level to make sure that the Constitution is upheld. So the courts happen to be just one branch of government. There are other branches of government that people should appeal to. And so that's part of what's articulated in the piece, while also being mindful that there are times in which the court has failed us. I mean, let's be clear, there are times in which the state legislature has failed us too, but these are the branches of government, though, that we have, right? I mean, unless one is interested in being engaged in anarchy, which I don't recommend for people to be engaged in, then what's really in front of people is the opportunity to use these tools of democracy. And prior to this administration, the Department of Justice, since 1965, had been on this track, arm in arm with citizens, to protect voting rights in the United States. We've seen through this particular administration and in the wake of the Shelby County decision, which is the one that I referenced earlier, where the Department of Justice no longer serves that robust type of role that really did protect voting rights. And in fact, just last week on my podcast on the issues with Michelle Goodwin, I had on individuals who are right there, lawyers who are in the field, who work on voting protection. And they said that, you know, it was a pleasure, right, if you could think about it that way, to work with the Department of Justice, because there were lawyers there who were absolutely committed to making sure that voting rights were protected. They're just simply not seeing that today. And that's the real, you know, tragedy behind this all, multiple tragedies behind this.
This is The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
And we're speaking about the Supreme Court and the presidency in the USA with my two esteemed colleagues, Associate Professor of History Jennifer Frost, Politics and Policy Lecturer Tim Fadjin, and the Chancellor's Professor of Law at University of California, Irvine, Michelle Bratchett Goodwin. Jennifer Frost,
One thing that I find interesting is the attention to voter suppression in a way that is much broader and more general than we've seen before. So I was looking at an interview with a white Republican woman in Houston who was very angry with Governor Abbott's decision to have just one drop-off, right, for the county, Harris County, that Houston's in. And she said, I'm a Republican. I'm a white woman. My vote's being suppressed. You know, in this, I think that's to the good in a sense. It's outrageous. The voter suppression is outrageous. But if it's raising consciousness and awareness among all constituencies that the vote's being suppressed, I guess that's my silver lining, you know, little glimmer of hope there.
Sure. Well, the reality is that racism hurts us all. Right. And that's the reality. I think that for so long with a kind of nationalist instincts that have been part of, you know, American history and legacy, it's been perceived that racism just simply hurts Indigenous people, or it hurts Black people, or it hurts the, you know, people of color who are new immigrants. But the reality is that any time in which we're compromising our constitutional values, when we're assaulting our democracy, that really is an attack that we're all subject to. And even if it doesn't hit us immediately, it does in the long run. This is what I refer to as Black people being the canaries in the coal mine. You know, eventually there's no oxygen for anybody. It just happens to be that it's Black people who might suffer first. But eventually it catches up to everyone, potentially.
Michelle Goodwin, you referenced earlier, you called it a Trump court because of all the Trump nominees. And we could probably look across the federal courts and the packing of the courts with Trump nominees who seem to be far more ideologically driven than legally driven in some cases. We know that legislation can get stopped by the court, even though that wasn't in the original Constitution. We know that we've got judicial review as a tradition now. What are the potential solutions to this, again, sort of assault on democracy from the other end?
So just so that your listeners can learn a bit more about this, the critique that some are saying in terms of that there is a Trump court is a critique that's being made by academics and those in civil society and even by some judges, is the fact that President Trump has now been able to nominate and get through the confirmation process more federal judges than any other president save George Washington. And this has also been colored by things that we've not seen in a presidential administration in decades. That is that as of July, of those that were nominated to the federal bench as appellate judges and confirmed, none were African American. As of July, only one Latino. We've just simply not seen that. You didn't see that during a Bush administration, during a Reagan administration, through either Bush administration. So these are some of the concerns. Now, how to deal with this? Some say that what the next president should do, if it's not Donald Trump, they're saying, is to expand the size of the court. Well, that's not unusual. There is no designation in the Constitution, the federal Constitution, that the Supreme Court has to consist of a particular size. There have been times in which the court has been had fewer seats. There are times in which the Supreme Court has had more seats. We had federal appellate courts expand in size during the Carter administration. So what some are saying is add seats to the Supreme Court. There's some that say that this is not a long-term solution at all, because this is then a game that Republicans can play later. What you really do see is a crisis of democracy in the United States. Others are saying that, look, the underlying problem here is that we're still dealing with an electoral college, which is a system that was set up during slavery. That is true. And so some have said the way to address that is to make statehood of Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico such that then they can have more senators added to Congress and then get legislation through. So those are some of the ideas that are being vetted right now in the United States.
Tim Fadjin?
Just really interesting ideas, and they call into question, I think, a theme that's really coming through in our conversation today, but maybe also over the last several weeks, which is this general erosion of trust and confidence in the government. I think one of the issues that's come up with COVID-19 that we've been sort of discussing here in New Zealand is why have things sort of, besides sort of geography and other reasons, why have some things been handled better here than elsewhere? And one of the reasons people often cite to is the strong social cohesion, the ability to sort of follow the instructions, to stick together. And that seems to be lacking from what at least we see in media coverage, discussion of politics in the United States. I think sitting through the debate last week, this was very apparent as well, and not just based on the policy issues, but even the responses following the debate. In particular, the issues that were brought up about race in the debate. And I'm wondering, you know, this theme that the president keeps coming back to and sort of saying that he's second only to Abraham Lincoln and his accomplishments for Black Americans. I'm wondering, what do you make of that? And
so this has been a very interesting time for our country. If we were to just think about this within the COVID lens, which you mentioned, COVID has exposed underlying institutional and infrastructural inequalities in our society. But in reality, the tattered fabric of that was also being shown during the Obama administration as well. Many people, journalists, didn't really cover it. I've spoken with journalists since then who said that they saw the racism, but they didn't think that it was racism. So they saw Americans coming to the White House in 2010, 2011, protesting outside with effigies of the president that were very racialized, with bone through the nose, with bulging eyes and big lips. And they said they didn't see it as racist. Now, clearly it was racist ideology, but they weren't framing it as such. And so even with the rise of the Tea Party, 2010, this was backlash against Barack Obama. Now you have to think, you know, the biggest controversy for so many people during the Obama years was he wore a tan suit. And that seems laughable today, right? People said, well, he talked about arugula and wasn't he elitist? And, you know, as my daughter has said, arugula is grown by farmers, right? Like, so the very idea of painting him as being out of touch with Americans when he's talking about some greens, some wild greens, you know, grown by farmers. And that was it. But the kind of racist vitriol, and I wrote a couple of pieces during the time, and so I had to do some research on this and was mortified to see the websites that people had bothered to set up proposing to kill him, proposing to kill his children. I mean, the racial venom associated and against Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, et cetera, the real tragedy there, I think, in part, is that the media didn't take it into account and portray it for what it was. The media didn't take into account when Mitch McConnell was saying, we're just going to say no, we're just not going to support anything this president does. They covered it as this is just politics, rather than what else is associated with this. And so Donald Trump was able to rise during that kind of space, and then to further these narratives, the anti-Muslim narrative, the anti-Mexican narrative, the anti-whole continent of Africa narrative, all very much racialized from the very beginning. We now have people who are marching up to states like Michigan with Confederate flags, right? So what we used to associate with Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, Louisiana has now made its way all across the United States. That's something that we have to take quite seriously. And I think that people are taking that seriously. I think there are a lot of white people who are deeply concerned about this in the United States, who are wondering what were they missing all this time now that they see these nationalist groups. And let me just close that with saying it's so bad that there are a group of white men who were conspiring to kidnap and I guess possibly kill the governor of Michigan, all because she wanted people in Michigan to wear masks during COVID. So there is a dramatic difference between how people are addressing COVID in New Zealand And what is transpiring in the United States, and I think it's a mix of racism, of sexism, of misogyny, and all of these things you can find in the White House. And it's spilling beyond the White House into all areas of our country.
Jennifer Frost?
I was thinking of a number of things, but I think that idea that the social good that Tim just mentioned, right? So in New Zealand, there still is this idea of, you know, that we're together in a country, that we need to take care of each other, whereas that kind of rhetoric of freedom on the part of these white nationalists and the Trumps, et cetera, you know, as if your freedom can get me infected, you know, you have the right to get me infected to preserve your freedom. And it's just that idea is lacking. But I do think, again, I keep feeling like I'm the glasses half full person on this podcast, on this broadcast, which is that I think Biden and the Democrats are trying to make the argument of we are still one country and we do have to look out for one another. And I think that is appealing.
Yeah. And I guess I would only just say again, the experiences that you described in Minneapolis, the examples of racism that you and your family experienced, the examples from your last answer that made me think of how I grew up in Massachusetts, and we sort of used to always think, well, we are not racist and we don't have a racist history, until you looked into the reactions that forced busing had, and it was some of the worst in the United States. So we have these sorts of moments where if we have that humility and that moment and that opportunity to reflect and take a moment to think about our past. And this was something that I thought came through in the debate when Biden had admitted that some of the policies around criminal justice were mistakes. And how often have you heard the president ever say this? And even in the context of COVID, saying, I take responsibility, but it's not my fault. So it's wanting to have it all and nothing at the same time. And so I thank you for your thoughts today. I thought it was really, really engaging, really interesting. And
Michelle Goodwin.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you all. Thank you. You know, I don't think that any of this is mutually exclusive in terms of hope. I don't think that Black people would have survived from the original voyages had they not maintained some sense of hope. And I think about that. And I also think about the foreign places that sheltered them. So I'll close with this. Very recently, I've been thinking about North Stars, and I'm amazed by the people who were brought shackled and chained to places like Mississippi, and imagined that there was a place called Canada. They had no GPSs, no special maps, no parkas, no special boots, and walked. And to this day, there are communities in Canada of people who were formerly enslaved in the United States, and they had no special trains, no special cars, but they had this hope of a vision of something that was better that would protect their human dignity and integrity. And so I do think that that hope persists. I think that's exactly why people are fighting so hard to vote in the United States.
Michelle Goodwin, Tim Fadjin, Jennifer Frost, thank you so much.
When we come back, how has class identity shaped American politics and elections? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
Here with my two colleagues, Tim Fadjin, lecturer of politics and policy, and Jennifer Frost, associate professor of American history. On Zoom with us today is Nancy Eisenberg, a professor of American history at Louisiana State University and author of The Problem of Democracy and the New York Times bestseller White Trash, the 400-year Untold History of Class in America. That was published in 2016, just as Donald Trump was entering the White House. Welcome, all three of you. It's so great to be with the two of you again, and great to meet you, Nancy Eisenberg. Thanks so much for being with us. Having done this research on class in a historic context, what do you feel like it tells us about today and what we're dealing with in today's politics in the United States?
You know, this is what historians often say, that we do repeat the past because there are things that become normalized, aspects of political behavior, which is what I focus on, political culture. And I think that one of the key tensions that I focus on in my book is that Americans are very caught up in their myths, and all nations are, their myths of what America stands for. And our myth has been shaped, it can go all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, to the founders, but our myth is shaped around the idea that we are the land of opportunity, that somehow we broke free from those monarchies in Europe and magically remade ourselves into a more egalitarian society. That is a myth. And it's even more of a myth today, because there's far more social mobility in many European countries, but by the simple fact that they provide social services. Today in America, if you want to make it, the most important determinant is the class background of your forebears and the class background of your parents and all the money they invest in you. Because on average, an average American family today, and we're talking about mainly middle class, and this is what happens, is they will invest 50% of their total wealth in their children. And that essentially means, if you think about what it takes to succeed in society today, you need an education, you need to be living in a safe neighborhood, you need access to the best food, the best grocery stores, the best healthcare. All those things are determined by class. So the problem is that in America, the myth has often concealed what is the reality. And what I do in my book is I show that even with the myth, almost every major political moment, even the Civil War, class comes to the surface because it can't be concealed, because it does divide people. What I find so amazing today, we want to simplify our class into three groups, which is a fallacy. There's not just the super wealthy or the ridiculous 1% and then everyone else, or the super wealthy, the middle class and the lower class. Even in the Civil War, people recognized there were at least six different classes. And what I like to focus on is the class tension is not just between us and the 1%, but it's the tensions that exist between the middle class and the lower class. And that often gets disguised because we assume, well, of course, everyone wants to get into the middle class, but then everyone can't. And often getting in the middle class means leaving those elements of your working class or lower class behind and denying. When White Trash came out, I had so many people writing me say, this is what happened to me. And that when I go home to my, you know, where I grew up, I still feel intimidated by people who were the families that mattered in that community. So that's what we don't tell the truth about, because the middle class is not endlessly expansive. And we deny that class tension isn't just, we can't just blame everything on the 1%. We have to look at how we are given privileges as part of the middle class. And it becomes very uncomfortable to admit that we have those kinds of privileges. And we didn't just earn them. Often they're privileges that came from being fortunate enough to be born to.
I think what you're getting to is that these politicians like Donald Trump exploit these myths in a particular way. How do you see that being shaped today?
Yeah, this is what I say over and over again. What Donald Trump is doing is, I know everyone thinks it's new. I wrote about, you know, Sarah Palin paved the way for him. She was clearly a reality TV candidate. And it was the assumption that anyone could be reshaped for modern media and made into a presidential candidate. She failed, but she opened the door for him. But it even goes back further. One of the key areas where we see this is in Southern politics. Southern politics in the late 19th century and 20th century, you had to be an entertainer. And you had to pretend, even though many of the politicians who were running came from the middle class, they had to pretend that they were part of the working class. So there was a Jefferson Davis, not the Civil War president, but a Jefferson Davis who ran in Arkansas. And every time he stood before a crowd, he'd get up there and rip off his collar, roll up his sleeves. LBJ had to travel with a band. essentially another candidate from Alabama, when he got on the stage, he was barefoot. The performative side of politics is essential. And this, I mean, I don't know how you feel about Australians, but there was an Australian observer who wrote in 1949, he said that what America has, and this is actually an older concept, we have a democracy of manners, not a real democracy. And that means everyone who runs has to pretend to be as if they're one of the people, an average Joe. But the class division means that that's not true. Every time we elect someone, we give them incredible power. They are not one of us. And it's all a performance. With Trump, what matters, the reason he exploits it, is the way he talks. Now, everybody knows he comes from the upper class. You know, he came down the escalator pretending he was coming down from his penthouse to commingle with the masses. But it's his crude way of speaking that really taps into that old Southern political style. And that's where people, they imagine he's more authentic. That's why many voters who supported Trump were rejecting Republicans, not just Hillary, because they didn't want the candidate who was so calm, collected, but felt false because they were a practiced politician. They were caught up in the illusion that all Trump and all his fallacies, all speaking off the top of his head, his incredible ability to lie and lie and lie and be a con man, all those performative elements get confused with somehow he's speaking the truth. He's speaking in my language. It's like having a conversation in a bar and the guy sitting on the stool at the end of the bar is who President Trump pretends to be every time he opens his mouth and talks.
You know, Jennifer Frost, I'm going to turn to you because one of your observations was around identity politics, but this is not the kind of identity politics that seems to be articulated.
Yeah. One of the issues of 2016 was the way in which identity politics were at play on both sides. So we've always thought of identity politics as on the progressive side or the left, thinking about feminism, thinking about civil rights, gay rights, et cetera. So what we saw with Trump was the identity politics of the right. So, you know, being white, being Christian, being male.
He's not a very good Christian.
Yeah, that's remember, right. That's right. That's
right. You know, how he quoted Galatians. I'm sorry, the guy has never cracked the Bible and knows nothing about religion.
That's right. So, but what's your sense? I mean, was identity politics as central in 2016 as we've analyzed it? And where do you think we're at today with this?
Well, you know, this is what I'm saying. This identity politics goes back. Thomas Jefferson engaged in identity politics. He dressed down. That was what Virginian elites did when they went to commingle with the average voter and treated them, giving them free fruit and drink. You know, they didn't dress in the most expensive clothing. They dressed down. So identity politics is rooted. It's part of, it's an essential strain in American politics. It's not new. But yes, I think that in 2016, what happened is the media, for the first time, decided they were going to pay attention to class. They're not paying attention to class this time around. In fact, they're ignoring it. I just did a search of the Washington Post for the word class, which they never like to use. And it really came up three times, you know, like three articles in the past 3 months. And the two articles were saying the same thing, because Joe Biden has revived a class rhetoric. He is appealing to being the man from Scranton, and he's talking about Donald Trump being part of those snooty elites that essentially want you to cut the grass at the country club, but won't let you inside. And what's funny about that, that's the same campaign rhetoric that Jimmy Carter used when he ran in Georgia, when he was running against another Democrat, because he had to distinguish himself and saying, I'm the man for the people. So he had pictures of Jimmy Carter had pictures of him riding on his tractor. But Joe Biden, it's actually true. I've been to Scranton. And if you look at his class background, he had to work a lot harder to get ahead. And he does understand the experiences of working people that Trump has no understanding of whatsoever. He's never associated with people of those, except for as underlings, except for as people, you know, who he doesn't want to pay their bills, you know, who worked on his construction projects. But it's one of those things where with the identity politics, Jennifer's right, it's often been blamed on the left because a lot of people who criticize the left wanted a neutral language. They wanted to go back to this idea that, you know, American citizenship, we all believe in these basic ideals, and they thought they could get rid of all identity politics. But campaigns are all about personality. I mean, why did they attack Hillary Clinton? Why did they say she didn't have charisma? Like, who cares? I want someone who knows how to govern. But we use all these ridiculous variables, which the media just reinforce.
And it seems like there is a sort of masking of that particular identity politics of class, as you have pointed out, whereas the others are emphasized, such as race and gender and that sort of a thing. Tim Fadjin, let's bring you in.
Picking up with what you were just saying, you had a really great quote at the beginning of White Trash, which is a great book. I was happy to pick that up. You mentioned one thing we can do in the interest of national self-improvement is to further the conversation about the manipulations of class identity by political aspirants who game the system each time they sell unreal expectations to people whose interests they only pretend to represent. And you close that by saying, if we do not study ourselves with due attention to disturbing patterns in our own history, we'll be learning little, and democracy can scarcely claim to be the best form of government. So I think we can say now, it's been several years since this book came out, the national discourse has, let's say, not benefited from the Trump presidency in this regard. But I wonder if you get the sense that his supporters at least feel, even if they were manipulated to a certain extent, that at least he was transparent about it. And since his public utterances and policy positions generally aligned with what they felt theirs were, that this was just sort of a fortunate confluence of circumstances. And since there was no pretense of doing anything that remotely benefited the libs, that this was sufficient.
Yeah, no, I definitely see. I think that a lot of his supporters, it's not like they necessarily care about Trump. What they see him as, they see him as their advocate. Every time he gets up there and attacks Democrats, attacks Hollywood liberals, all the people who the Republicans have for years painted as the enemy. And every time that he claims to reflect the dispossessed. You remember, I mean, it just came out recently, he claimed he was going to represent the forgotten Americans, which of course he completely forgot about because he never cared about them at all. But the key thing is they see him as, and this is what's sad, creating a space where his anger reflects their anger. And I think, unfortunately, and you know this as political scientists, often people do not vote their self-interest. Often they vote maybe for one issue. We know that evangelicals vote on the abortion issue. That's the most important thing. Regardless, this is why evangelicals can support Trump, even though he's immoral. But I really think this is the danger. The danger is that I find so frustrating is he doesn't even have to do anything. It used to be that politicians actually had to give something back. There was pork barrel. There was something they had to do for their constituency.
Well, there was stimulus. There was a one-time stimulus during COVID. I mean, you know, 220,000 dead, but at least, you know, he tried to give a stimulus, they say.
Yeah, but even that, I think he was coerced to do because, you know, he's out there now claiming, and this is the thing that's really scary about Trump. You know, he's a eugenicist. He believes in social Darwinism, survival of the fittest. That's why he's running around saying he's immune. So he, and this is where he does reflect my other book, he really is the cult of personality. And he knows how to play that role. This is what he did learn from, you know, world wrestling. And this is what he learned about from reality TV. And even reality TV was social Darwinism, by the way. So that kind of fit his thinking. And the guy who produced The Apprentice is the same guy who's helping orchestrating his campaign.
This is The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
And with us is politics and policy lecturer Tim Fadjin and American history professors Nancy Eisenberg and Jennifer Frost. And we're talking about how class and identity politics and the myths of American politics are shaping today's elections. Nancy Eisenberg, that brings up a really important point, I think, too, which you started to talk about, which is this kind of show, the entertainment aspect. In your other book about the problems of democracy, you cited even the founder, you know, John Adams, talking about how that's what voters want, you know, that they're It's the cult of personality. It's the kind of hero worship and the celebrity. Has there ever been a time in American history where it has not been that?
Well, see, you can't escape it. See, this is why, like, you know, John Adams is usually portrayed as the villain, but he was very smart and he understood class. That's why I like him. He understood class dynamics. And the whole cult of personality is the way that lower classes deferred to elites. And they admired the rich. All the rich in Europe put on a performance. They would ride in their fancy carriages. They would appear in their dress. And in fact, the reason we have this performance around the presidents is because, unfortunately, the presidency has become a surrogate for a kingship. And that's something that John Adams was also very worried about, because many English critics were talking about the dangers of, you know, how you can replicate royal authority and it gets transported in even into the American Constitution. I mean, the president's right of pardon, where do you think that comes from? There are many elements, unfortunately, in our and then it's really in the 20th century that the presidency around people like John F. Kennedy, remember Camelot, and it's the modern media, and then you have Reagan, who was Hollywood celebrity, that entertainment and kingship become intertwined. And the cult of personality, which is usually seen as a 20th century phenomenon, but I think it has older roots if you look at aristocracy and royalty and the way in which, do I have to mention Versailles? I
mean, and yet one of the myths in America is really sort of the opposite of this, right? This idea of egalitarianism and equality. Jennifer Frost, I want to turn to you for a moment because you've really looked also at the progressive movement. And was that a time that was different at all?
Well, yes, I guess this is what I've been thinking about is, when has it been a time when elections were about issues, right? So our thinking for this week was really, you know, what motivates voters, right? Is it issues like you just mentioned, the Christian evangelicals, and it's about the abortion issue? Is it issues, or is it identities, or how do these, kind of conflate? But it seems to me there were historical moments of crises where real public policy was discussed. You know, I think of the Progressive Era. I think of the New Deal.
Maybe remind us a little bit about the Progressive Era for those who don't know.
Sure. So the Progressive Era, we think of that as the, you know, first couple of decades of the 20th century, when all the big forces of industrialization, immigration, class conflict were coming to the fore. And we have a progressive movement which really sought to democratize the U.S. Government. And society. Even the populace who came before them, which were the farmers who organized against big corporations and, you know, again, tried to democratize the American political system. I mean, they did talk about policy issues. The New Deal during the Great Depression, there were policy issues. I'm doing research right now on the 1960s, and they're, you know, talking about the Electoral College and, you know, is this democratic, et cetera. So it does seem like there are these historical moments where the real fact of politics and the need does cut through, but it seems few and far between. But I'm wondering, are we at that moment now? I think of the dueling town halls of Trump on one channel and Biden on the other. And the candidate Biden had a bigger audience and he had a bigger streaming audience. And many people were saying, boy, people were tuning in to hear about tax policy, you know, compared to Trump talking about QAnon. So do you think we're at a moment where maybe the reality of COVID, the reality of economic crisis, are we going to get real political issues being dealt with?
You know, I think it's always hard because if you broke down the population, you would find that there's always a contingent that cares about issues and policy. Even in the New Deal, I mean, if you look at or the progressives, I mean, there's a difference between being a Southern progressive and being a progressive in Wisconsin. But I mean, that overlapped with the eugenics movement, and some progressives were eugenicists. So it's hard to not, you know, recognize that even when they are talking about issues, those issues can get slanted in a way that is still disturbing. And I think that it also depends who you're looking at in terms of voters. I just wish we would stop listening to polls, or at least poll people in a way that matters, where we would follow up, not just ask people what they think, but then ask them to explain what they think. Because that's when you can really see if anyone understands the issues. Because they may have a feeling. They may, you know, think that, well, I do like Trump because he reduced my taxes. And then if you press them on that, you'd say, well, who actually got the tax cuts? And force people to at least respond. But it's still hard because, you know, the other thing I put into my new preface in White Trash is that people can always rationalize. People can find a justification for what they think, find any kind of evidence to back up what they think, and ignore what is the most clear and telling evidence if they choose to.
That reminds me of Drew Weston's work, where he actually scanned the brains of partisans. And if they got information that was true, but that countered their framing and their belief system, you could actually see on the brain scans the cognitive dissonance.
And the media just contributes to that because we all live in our own media bubble. We all can get news that just ratifies our own views. And I think it's very, very unhealthy. And I am not a fan of Twitter. I think that Twitter mobs, everything they do makes things worse. There are people who are circulating interesting information that you might not see if you just read like the Times or the Washington Post. But I think there's a really unhealthy side to the internet, to Twitter, the way in which it's about deciding, are you my friend or my enemy? And it's really about just drawing lines and then attacking anyone who dares says one thing that you disagree with, and then labeling them, stamping a label on their head. Like Jill Lepore wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post, and she was just vilified because, you know, she doesn't want the Biden administration, if Biden wins, to come in and sort of engage in a kind of full-fledged revenge against Trump and everything he stands for. And people didn't read the op-ed closely, but they immediately saw her as an apologist and then attacked her like, oh, Harvard's history department has gone down in quality. And I'm like, you know, this is not a discussion. And this is coming from people who are Democrats on the left, because they're the only people reading the Washington Post.
Tim Fadgen, so we're talking about identity and issues, and you're a policy scholar. How does policy come into this that you see?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things that come in from the last conversation there. And some of your work was also, it reminded me of a recent work that just came out. Harvard philosopher Michael Sandel has a book called The Tyranny of Merit, where he's talking about the meritocracy and some of these issues that both of you are just speaking to. And basically this notion of Americans as self-made, those who succeed deserve the fruits of their success, and those at the bottom are sort of there because of some moral failing. But the crux of his argument is that basically this shows a lack of humility, and primarily amongst those at the top of the order, I'd assume. And you touched on this a bit earlier, that this sort of lack of recognition of the hardships that people who are sort of on the losing side face, and this lack of humility as a barrier to achieving a more fair and kind society. So just like to a question, I guess, for you, sort of, again, back to a point you made in White Trash, looking at sort of presidential candidates, you say, are not, quote, masters of their own destiny. They're a patchwork of rhetorical scripts, familiar gestures, political styles that are inherited. And we kind of started the discussion today with this. But do you think there are any scripts, gestures, styles left in the debris field for somebody that could grasp onto that would sort of promote this idea of humility a bit?
See, I think it's really hard because, you know, this comes out of my work, which Jennifer will appreciate, television scholarship. Television scholars say the reason we get so many like CSIs is that the familiar is what sells. And politicians have always relied on what is familiar because it taps into what something people know and they'll have a positive response to it. So I think it's really, and in fact, it's almost against the interest of a politician to go out on a limb and make an argument that would be seen as so original. People couldn't understand exactly what he was talking or she was talking about. But I liked your first comment about this problem about meritocracy, because there's two, You know, I refer to this. In the 18th century, they used the argument, you were born to your station. And that becomes a foundation for racism. It becomes a foundation for sexism. But meritocracy, just like being born to your station, assumes that they're going to be losers. Assumes if you're born to your station, that's where you belong. And there's no upward mobility. You just are there. Meritocracy, the danger is that it divides. And this is part of Trump's rhetoric. It's winners versus losers. I mean, how many times have we heard him say that? And that is, that means that you have, as he has, no sympathy for people who don't have all the privileges, don't have a wealthy father who gives you everything, don't have someone who takes your PSATs so you can get into college. Don't steal the wealth from your relatives. You know, I mean, essentially, that's the irony with Trump, is that everything he has, he's not successful. He's not honest. He essentially is the master con man. And that's what I also highlight. He fits another trope of the story of the Arkansas traveler, where the politician, in a sense, has to go into the backwoods and play the role of being the backwoods person in order to convince people to trust him. So we wear masks. And this is, you know, this is a part of the theory of psychology or performance, that we all wear masks, but all politicians have to wear masks. And this is, you know, the internet and then television started it, where people thought they were seeing the real candidate, because you get a false sense of intimacy with television. You get a false sense of intimacy with other forms of video and media. So, you know, in a sense, this is the danger. Politicians are never going to be as honest as we'd like them to be, because we, the voters, don't want them to be honest. You know, we have to stop blaming politicians for only being con men, but realize the audience wants to be fed certain stories that make them feel good, that ratify their existence or what they think is the world they want.
With that, thank you so much, Nancy Eisenberg, Tim Fadjin, Jennifer Frost. Really wonderful and informative session. It's been a great pleasure being with you all again. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Having me.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.